I've never really used one of these. Tell me, Mr. Bannon, what do you have to say about this?
It's an all-new, all-different podcast from Lawyers, Guns, and Money.
Hello, listeners of the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. It's been a while since our last podcast, but hopefully the next one will roll around a little bit sooner and with a little bit less gap in between. My name is Robert Farley. I am a visiting professor at the United States Army War College in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, although I am currently on loan from the Patterson School of Diplomacy and International Commerce at the University of Kentucky. Today I have with me Dr. Colin Snyder, who is an associate professor of history at the University of Texas at Tyler and a specialist in Brazil and Brazilian politics.
As people might guess, given your professional focus on Brazil, and given that something happened in Brazil, we're going to talk about Brazil today. So tell us, what the heck is going on in Brazil?
It's a carnival of sorts that they recently had their first round of presidential elections. And of course, this has been quite a anticipated election for the last couple of years, dating back to the impeachment slash coup, depending on how you call it, of Dilma Rousseff in 2016 and the assumption of her vice president. And this sort of whole phenomenon of corruption cases surrounding Lava Jato. Of course, she was impeached for issues that were framed as corruption, but really were a different matter altogether, that were of actions that were legal at the time that she did them and then subsequently declared illegal while she was president. So basically what you had heading into this election then was Lula, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, was planning on being the candidate again to run for a second presidential go-round. He was president for 8 years from 2003 to 2011 and then was going to run again. But he was ensnared in this very dubious application of this corruption case where, with far less evidence, he was sentenced and or convicted and sentenced to prison, while senators who had plenty more evidence against them had their cases sort of tabled. Mm-hmm. And so he had planned on running for the PT, the Workers' Party, but then was prohibited from doing that. And he remains in prison presently. And so that sort of threw up in the air this whole question of who's going to be president, who would the PT run, who was going to run, because you had sort of this discrediting of so many other candidates because of their ties to corruption. So what ended up happening was you had the emergence of this far-right fringe candidate, this Brazilian, I think fascist is not too strong a term in this instance, Jair Bolsonaro, who'd sort of always framed himself as an outsider. And sort of akin to what we saw in the United States, right? This general contempt for politics as usual, leading to some rather extreme candidates. So what you ended up having was Jair Bolsonaro, who's very famous for his his homophobia, his misogyny, his racism. And none of these are, you know, you don't have to read between the lines on any of these things. He's quite clear about all of them. He's a former military officer, so he's very he's been very apologetic and advocating for military coups again. That, you know, amongst the various things he said is that the Brazilian dictatorship, which killed 434 people and tortured thousands, that it didn't go far enough. That he, you know, famously said Pinochet killed more people in Chile than he did. And he ends up winning the first round of the – he doesn't win the election, but in Brazil you have two rounds. And if a candidate doesn't reach 50% in the first round, then you have a runoff between the top two candidates. And Bolsonaro, who was predicted to be the leader heading into the election, surprised many by finishing even higher than they'd anticipated with 46% of the total votes in Brazil. And then the runner-up was Fernando Haddad of the PT. That was sort of Lula's stand-in. He'd been former mayor of São Paulo and – so he got 30% of the vote, and now those two men will face off in a runoff at the end of this month.
Right. So what is the party structure of Bolsonaro's appeal, right? I mean, is this a sort of Trump-style takeover of a previously existing? I know very little about Brazil's party structure,
right,
and I doubt a lot of the listeners are going to know a lot about it either.
Sure. So Brazil has numerous parties. It basically operates on this system of presidential parliamentarism where a president can win, but then he's going to have to build a coalition in Congress to get anything to – or she in the case of Dilma Rousseff. And Bolsonaro is actually from the PSL, the Social Liberal Party, which is not it's sort of the, you know, the universal definition of liberal, that it's very much national conservatism. It's nationalist. It's highly conservative, that its members have to take a pledge to never even collaborate with or coalition with leftist parties. It's a very small party. It only was, of course, and if I may backtrack very quickly, Brazil's history of parties is pretty limited because they had a military dictatorship from 1964 to 85. So that a lot of the extant parties you had prior to the dictatorship, those were declared illegal in 1965, and the dictatorship created two new parties. So that when they returned to democracy, you sort of get this flourishing of a brand new set of parties all across the spectrum. So you have a large number of parties. And the PSL is one of the smaller ones. Mm-hmm. It was only created in 1994, and it's when it ran, in elections in 2002 for Congress, it got one out of 513 seats. It got none in 2006. So it's a very fringe party. It currently has about 50 members in the Chamber of Deputies out of just under 500, so roughly 10%, and just 2% of the senators. Four, I believe it's around four out of 81. And no governors, right? So this is very much, I think, a case of Bolsonaro as a person rather than the PSL as a party. This isn't like Trump, where you had an entrenched party that he sort of operated outside of and ended up becoming the spokesperson and leader of. Right.
Is there precedent for a party this small doing this well in a presidential election?
Yes, but mostly immediately after the... So that you have the opposition win the first presidential election, which is an indirect election in 1985. That's still going to be Congress that has the vote, not the popular vote. But the first popular vote in Brazil after the dictatorship is in 1989, where you have Fernando Collor, who's this very he at the time is a very young and up-and-coming and handsome politician in a small party, and he sort of came out of nowhere to win the election through – the media was very much in favor of him, and that was the first presidential election Lula had run in. And the media, Globo in particular, very much manipulated the debates and the images of the two men to sort of make it so that Collor won at the end. Of course, he's impeached, or not impeached, he resigns under the threat of impeachment in 1992 because it turns out he was massively corrupt. That doesn't mean he's not a senator today, because he is, but that's a different issue. So there was that was a case, though, where there wasn't really... that he was the party, effectively. That party sort of went nowhere after him. And then, but for the last really 24 years, it's really come down to two parties. The PSDB, which is the Social Democratic Brazilian Party, the Brazilian Social Democratic Party, and the PT, right? The PSDB is who wins the elections in 1994 with Fernando Henrique Cardoso, who then again wins the re-election in 1998. And then in 2002, Lula beats the top PSDB candidate, and he does it again in 2006. And 2010, Dilma beats the PSDB, and in 2014 again. Mm-hmm. So the Social Liberal Party is very much this sort of the two dominant parties, at least in the presidential elections the last 20-plus years, have been the PT and the PSDB.
So when is the runoff, and what are the prospects for Bolsonaro in the runoff? I mean, is he to be understood as the favorite here? Is he going to pick up anything from any of the other candidates, or is there going to be is there the potential for? I mean, he only got 46, right? So, is there a potential for people sort of saying, I've cast my protest vote against the establishment, and now we'll get real for the actual runoff election?
This is tough to say. So the runoff will be October 28th. So we have just over under 3 weeks before the runoff. In terms of how this shakes down, because Fernando Haddad of the PT was the main the runner up, right? And he's sort of center left. And then the third place candidate and he got 30% of the vote, 29%. And then the third place candidate was Ciro Gomes of the center left PDT, and he got another 12.5%. So even with those two combined, that adds up to, call it 42% against Bolsonaro's 46%. Now, the PSDB that had usually run well, they did have a candidate. He had lost in 2006 to Lula. His name was Geraldo Alckmin. He got just under 5% of the vote. Mm-hmm. So really what...
And that's center-right. Is that...
Yeah, that's center-right.
Right.
And so I suppose if the 4% of Alckmin went directly to Bolsonaro, that puts him over the edge. But what's also interesting is you had 6% of Brazilians cast a null vote, and almost 3% more leave their ballot blank. So there's going to be a lot of pressure. It's unclear what will happen with those null votes. Were they null because, to what extent will this be sort of, as you all put it regularly there, voting as a consumer model versus voting practically?
Right.
That it seems less likely that Haddad could come out of nowhere to win. But the other thing that sort of throws this into relief, and I'm thinking here historically, is when Alckmin ran against Lula in 2006, they both had to go to runoff as well. Lula fell just shy of the 50% needed. And in the runoff, Alcmin actually lost a couple million votes. That around 2 or 3 million people who had voted for him in the first round did not vote for him in the second round. So we could see, I'm hesitant to say that can't happen here as well, where people look back on what they did and decide not to re-vote for Bolsonaro. Although Bolsonaro, again, he's sort of fascistic, and he has said that he will not accept any result that doesn't end in his victory.
Oh, well, that's terrific. I mean, that's always what you like to hear from a candidate. So dude is, fascistic. He is moving up through a party apparatus, which is not extraordinarily well developed, right, because it's so small. I will grant that these things seem alarming to me. Is his appeal then, is there a sort of I don't know if you would call this social conservative, but is there sort of a social conservative base that he's really appealing to here? Or is he's definitely primarily appealing to just protest?
Yeah, definitely appealing to middle and upper classes. This sort of hyper-nationalism that he's, again, overtly racist and sexist and homophobic, so that there's something that appeals when he talks about, that he's famously said that you're not a good policeman if you haven't killed somebody before. Mm-hmm. And then this sort of framing that's very deep, historically rooted framing of...
I mean, I'm hearing Duterte here, too, right?
It is sort of Duterte plus Duterte. Trump. Yeah, and so, there is a sense of taking back the country for the middle classes and the upper classes who feel that under the PT, these social programs that saw the social improvement of the working classes, that was a step backwards. And so there's partly the resonance of that. There's also just something to be said for hyper-nationalism. Uh-huh. That's a hell of a drug. And there is a degree of the protest vote. They're fed up with all these politicians, and he represents something new and exciting. There's also, one of his big things has been the need for Brazilians to have more guns. And so, and there was a wave of people voting on Sunday who, even though you're not supposed to take your phone into the booth with you, it showed them, pressing the button on the ballot with their gun, putting the barrel of their gun against the button to push it in to register their vote for Bolsonaro, and sort of openly boasting about this. So there's a sort of hyper-masculinity that's also – and its affiliation with weaponry that's being brought in here as well. So there's a number of factors that can't really be a single one pertaining to the votes, but any number of these could be causes as to why people have voted for him.
Right. So is there a transnational aspect to this at all? Right. I mean, whether we want to sort of associate global authoritarianism. I mean, I think that just in fact today, Bernie Sanders gave a speech about how U.S. foreign policy needs to be geared towards fighting back against sort of global authoritarian networks. Is this something that is, sort of just emerging from within Brazil, or does this have, I dare say, not to throw out two names, right? But I mean, it has a whiff of Steve Bannon, it has a whiff of Vladimir Putin, right? Is there anything here in terms of is there money? Are there arguments? That makes it sound similar to things that we've seen in Turkey, in the Philippines, in the United States, right? This global push for authoritarianism.
It's tough to say. I mean, I don't think so entirely in this case. And I could be mistaken on this, but the reason because it's so, at least in the Brazilian case, it's so driven by what has happened there in the last 4 years with this political unrest, the sort of discontent with the PSDB and the PT and the PMDB, which is sort of the kingmaker center party. But it was so wishy-washy that it doesn't really have an ideology. And that's the party of Michel Temer, the vice president who took over for Dilma. The economy's a mess.
Is there still a hangover from the World Cup and the Olympics as well?
I think that's partly it, right? That just sort of the degree to which there was government spending on these boondoggles and the economy's not doing great. For a country that looked like it was in such a strong position in 2007, 8, 9, it's fallen pretty far. And so I think there's a desire to try something new that's less about, and the other thing, too, and you asked about who's supporting Bolsonaro, a lot of them are young people. And, he very openly evokes the dictatorship period as sort of a missed opportunity, but they weren't alive for it. So some of the he has a lot of base of young supporters who just don't really have the historical context to understand just what this language leads to. that they know about the dictatorship, but they haven't lived it firsthand. So I think it's as much this sort of assertion of greatness in the face of what feels like tough times, rather than any broader, you know, that he's not making overtures to Duterte or to, you know, Erdogan, or he is referred to as Brazil's Trump, but and something that's great. So there are some elements there, and there have been reports, I'm not sure how accurate they are or not, but that Steve Bannon may be now advising Bolsonaro. So certainly that would make these transnational connections a little more overt. But I get the sense, at least from the votes, that it's as much about, it's less with a global look and more with an internal gaze.
Right. So sort of an indigenously driven make Brazil great again, right, if that
yeah,
makes any sense.
Yeah.
But one that sort of consciously adopts models from other places without necessarily, you know, sort of the sense that there's this network behind it.
Yeah, and to be fair, too, Bolsonaro hasn't come out of anywhere, like nowhere, rather. He's been in Congress for a while. He's done almost nothing effectively in Congress, but he has been sort of this has been his shtick for a long time. This isn't something he recently stumbled upon and became popular for. That he has long taken these stances of, you know, anti-gay rights, anti-abortion, pro-military, pro-gun. He's not a Johnny-come-lately to these ideas for the purposes of elections, that this is sincere. So this idea of make Brazil great again, it's more that his message that he's been spouting for a long time has hit a particular political and economic context that's more resonant now than it had been in the past.
Right. Okay, that makes sense. If he becomes president, what kind of struggles is he going to have to assemble a governing coalition, right? I mean, given the size of his party, I have to imagine that there are going to be some pretty significant struggles here, right?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Because he's going to have to do coalition building in a Congress where he has very little support, so that the congressional election, you know, PT has actually had a pretty good showing in Congress, and it's technically going to be the greatest number. I believe the PT has the most seats in the Chamber of Deputies at 56, and of course the Chamber of Deputies has over 100, so or 500. So there's that, and his party's only four behind that, and they picked up 44 votes too, to give you a sense of how rapid this ascent has been for that party. But then you have other groups like the PMDB, which is just, it's always been wishy-washy, but it could decide to go for or against Bolsonaro, or could split down the middle and do both. That you have the Labor Party, you have the Social Democracy Party, that you have the Progressive Party, right? That there's so many different parties, the Socialism and Liberty Party, the Labor Party, and there's the Communist Party, which actually has 9 seats, the Communist Party of Brazil, which has 9 seats, right? So there's going to be, I mean, if you look, I'm trying to remember off the top of my head, I want to say it's about 14 or 15 parties with double digit representation in Congress. So it's going to be a challenge for him to get a group that works with his policies.
Mm-hmm. Now, what sort of, do we have a sense of what the executive can do here in the United States, right? How does sort of the powers of the Brazilian executive differ in consequential ways from the powers of the U.S. executive, right? I mean, certainly, one alarming thing with respect to how you're describing him here is, you know, sort of the open admiration of authoritarian politics, right, and authoritarian usages. So, exactly what tools does the executive branch, I don't even know if they call it the executive branch in
they Brazil. Do,
yeah. Yeah. What tools does he have to sort of pursue his ends?
It's the coalition building, and this, ironically enough, the goal to pursue this ends, at least the institutional and democratic mechanisms to control the sort of constitutional mechanisms, are why there was such a case of corruption in Brazil in the first place. That because presidents were so dependent upon parties who didn't necessarily like them to get their plans, their agendas through Congress, that there was a lot of sort of bribing and money laundering going on. And this has been happening since the 90s, really. It's partly why both the PSDB and the PT have failed so miserably, or fallen so far. And so the obvious mechanism he could have to do this is buying off people, but that's sort of why there's anger and discontent at first. The more frightening one, you sort of alluded to it, is in his language of pro-dictatorship, his vice presidential candidate is also a former general, and that general has said that if there's chaos, you know, vaguely defined chaos in the country, then it's up to the president to sort of launch a self-coup, where you dissolve institutions and govern more in a Fujimori style in Peru than with the checks and balances of a Congress and a Supreme Court, effectively.
I mean, the military has to be willing to go along, right? I mean, is there? Right. I wasn't there. I was there 2 or 3 years ago, and you know, I was there very much as an outsider. But you know, I did not get the sense from talking to Brazilian military officers that there was a tremendous amount of nostalgia for sort of the period of military rulership.
Mm-hmm. There's not, but there is the possibility. I mean, Fujimori's self-coup happened without much. I mean, the military went along with it, but it wasn't that he could only do it because of the self-coup. The reason that Fujimori's self-coup worked in 92 is because the public was so much behind it. Mm-hmm. So they were basically thrilled that he was willing to just abrogate the Constitution and start over because of the guerrilla war with the Shining Path and the ongoing violence there, even though at that point paramilitary forces were as much responsible for violence as anything. So it's conceivable, and there's historical precedent for a politician doing this of his own free will, not with military backing, but just sort of against the party, and enough of the parties and the electorate are willing to go along with it.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, interesting. What does this look like in terms of actual sort of policies, both domestically and internationally? Now, we know that, you know, who knows, because, you know, he hasn't done it before, and so we don't know exactly what's going to happen. But, you know, in terms of what's going to change domestically, and I'm particularly interested, what's going to change internationally? Mm-hmm. You know, Brazil's not a member of NATO, right? But right. So you don't have – or the EU. So you don't have the same sort of situation as you have with Orban. But what can happen?
So there could be a great, a furthering of reduction of social programs and of privatization, and sort of opening Brazil to foreign markets without any – checks that he's already promised. He's begun looking at his potential cabinet should he win, and there's a lot of private businessmen on it. So in terms of trade, it could end up being, you know, a throwback to the 1990s with this sort of neoliberal free market application of to Brazil, which would have if he wins, it's going to have devastating effects on people in Brazil, especially the working classes, because the PT spent so many years building up these social programs that really did lead to improvements in a lot of people's lives, whether it's through, you know, school voucher, not school vouchers like in the United States, but basically paying families to let their children go to schools instead of having them work, or affirmative action programs, or just social welfare programs. That will see in a large erosion. And it's not incidental that the northeastern part of Brazil, which is historically one of the poorer parts of Brazil, if not the poorest compared with the north, is the other one. It's the one area that went uniformly for the did not vote for Bolsonaro in majority. There is this sort of that question. In terms of the military, that's a bigger question, too, because Bolsonaro, I mean, he was a lower level officer in the military, but it's not real clear. You know, this sort of comes back to what we were saying earlier about an internal gaze, a make Brazil great again, is it's not real clear what that would look like on the global stage, because, you know, if Trump could get elected saying that the world is laughing at us, well, Brazil's not had that sense of this sort of global importance that's inflated and now has deflated.
Right.
So that's one of the major questions, is because he's such a – he's done so little in Congress in terms of legislation, and because he's just been, you know – so vituperative towards socially marginalized people in Brazil, that there's not a lot of talk about his foreign policy, even, you know, even he himself, that's not a major arena that he focuses on. So it's a giant question mark, right? He's sort of an enigma on this front of what does Brazilian military policy in the world look like under Bolsonaro, or what do trade deals look like under Bolsonaro, or what alliances, you know, how does he deal with Venezuela or Argentina? This isn't real clear. I mean, obviously, he has great distaste for Venezuela because of Maduro and the Chavistas, you know, sort of being antithetical to Bolsonaro. But he's not a foreign policy wonk. He's not.
Right. I mean, at the very least, could we project an increase in military spending for Brazil, or does that sort of remain dependent on fiscal realities?
Yeah, I think that remains dependent on fiscal realities and on, you know, it depends on what Congress does. Does he have a Congress that works with him, or is there, you know, is he facing an obstinate Congress? The one thing, too, is I didn't forget this. He has promised, like Trump had, to withdraw from the Paris Climate Agreements if he wins.
Which is consequential. I mean, Brazil plays a significant role there, right?
Yeah, so. Yeah, and especially if you're going to be opening the market, you know, if you're opening the country to foreign investment further, then it's not like the country wasn't open to foreign investment or the PT, but an even more extreme version of this, and of course, with the there's already erosion of the Amazon through deforestation and for profit, so that if he withdraws from the Paris Climate Agreements, and you have this sort of opening of Brazil for business, and that could really take a devastating environmental effect, even as he's privatizing companies further, lowering taxes, your standard sort of bugaboos for the right.
Right. What has been the regional reaction? Right, are people is Argentina panicking? Right, I mean, what are countries around Brazil doing?
It's alarming, but it's not out of nowhere, because there has been, you know, after this sort of quote unquote pink tide throughout South America in the first part of the 21st century, with your Evo Morales's, your Chavez's, your Correa's in Ecuador, your Kirchner's in Argentina, Lula and Dilma in Brazil, that there has been this kind of pendulum shift back to center right neoliberalism in their political elections, and this sort of distaste for the long-term politics as usual. So he's less alarming in that front, or less he's extreme. He's less it's not that he's a unique figure from the right in a place that's in a region that's otherwise leaning left. It's that he's just a very extreme version of the right that has already sort of dominated. It's sort of like what we talk about, even in U.S. politics, where Trump, some see Trump not so much as an exception to the Republican Party, but just it's sort of unfiltered voice. And so Bolsonaro, there's not such an extreme, not repulsion, but confusion at his existence, because it is sort of a similar situation where he's just a very vocal version of a lot of the quieter policies and principles of the right.
All right. Well, I mean, over the next 4 weeks, what are you looking at, and what should observers more generally be looking at?
It'll be interesting to see how Brazilians mobilize around this. So right before the election, in fact, there was a big campaign called Ele Now, or Not Him, and you had tens of thousands of women in the streets protesting against his candidacy, mobilizing to sort of speak out and pressure people not to vote for him. So it'll be interesting to see if there is a sort of buyer's remorse among some. I'll be curious to see sort of how Haddad frames all this, right? That we've sort of not mentioned him, that there is a chance he could win. And if that's the case, then we're looking at a very different Brazil. In some regards, he may still have just as difficult a time trying to form a coalition in Congress, but a lot of those policies are going to be fundamentally different should he win. So what I'm really looking forward to is seeing what the polls look like in the next couple of weeks between the two men, how they are addressing one another, the substance and the style of their comments, and see if there is this broader mobilization that had just begun with that Ele Now movement and the women in the streets, and see if that extends further and sort of helps reshape the second round.
All right. Well, Colin, thanks so very much for joining us, and hopefully we'll have you back again, maybe after the election and after the fallout, and see how things are developing.
Thanks for having me.
All right, and thank you, listeners, to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. We hope to be with you again soon.